Hello and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on this Wednesday, July 22nd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Now we look at the stories on the front page. The headline, Great Weather Greets Volunteers at Annual Bible Reading Marathon. This is reported by Mike Brownlee. With temperatures in the low 80s, sunshine and shade, Tuesday was a perfect day to spend time outdoors. Steph the Squirrel Cage Jail, a group of local residents, read the Christian Bible aloud as part of the 5th Annual Iowa 99 County Bible Reading Marathon. Greg Barnston, an organizer of the event, quoted a few verses in explaining the rationale for the Pottawatomie County event, including a passage from the first book of Timothy, quote, "Till I, Jesus, come, attend to public reading of Scripture," unquote. Barnson said, "We believe, as we speak God's Word, that it's a creative force and has an effect. We believe we're accomplishing something, that's why we do it." On Tuesday afternoon, Barnston and a group of about 5 people were reading outside the historic jail, shaded by a tree. A few others had been there earlier before, leaving, and more were at home reading. "Because this year we have a lot of people reading at home, because of the COVID-19 pandemic," Barnston said, "that'll allow us to get through the entire Bible." "Thank God for this beautiful weather," Barnston added about the public portion of the event. In organizing the reading, Barnston started by allowing at-home readers to choose a chapter to read. From there, he assigned books of the Bible to volunteers as they arrived at the public reading. He said, "If they stay longer than one book, I'll assign another. Getting the job done." Volunteers on Tuesday included area residents from Council Bluffs, rural Pottawatomie County, and Omaha. "I see it as part of our freedom of speech," said volunteer Faye Kephart of Council Bluffs, who participated for the 5th time. "The Word of God tells us how we should live and how we should treat one another with love." The event was scheduled for 3 days, but Barnston said he expects to get through the Bible by the end of the day today. But volunteers are still encouraged to stop by if they'd like. Email Barnston at ggbarnstn@smith-peterson.com. ggbarnstn@smith-peterson.com. And that Peterson is spelled S-O-N. You can email him to volunteer. The article is accompanied by a picture on the front page of Greg Barnston reading the Christian Bible aloud outside the Squirrel Cage Jail as part of the 5th Annual Iowa 99 County Bible Reading Marathon on Tuesday. A second story on the front page, reported by Tim Johnson, "Return to Learn, Lewis Central Approves Plan Requiring Face Masks." The Lewis Central Community School District Board of Education approved a Return to Learn plan Monday that requires the use of facial coverings. Discussion reflected the proclamation issued by Governor Kim Reynolds Friday stating that school districts must provide at least half of their instruction in person. Superintendent Eric Nost said, noting that the governor's proclamation does not give local school boards a choice, he said, "We've been ordered to open schools in a brick-and-mortar setting. Several measures will be needed to protect staff and students," Knox said during the board meeting held on the Zoom video conferencing service. "It will be the district's expectation that staff and students utilize masks," he said. Originally, this policy was meant to apply only to staff and students in fourth grade or higher, Knox said. "Since I put this in writing, local public health officials have said they do recommend we extend that to all ages in our system," he said. The school district will provide washable, reusable masks and high-quality 3-ply masks, Noss said. "They will be more than just a cloth stretched across the face. They will not be medical-grade N95 masks." "The expectation that everyone wear masks cannot be absolute," Noss said. "For example, students could not be expected to wear masks while eating. In addition, there need to be mask breaks occasionally. In some cases, students might pull their mask down just to get a breath of fresh air." "We can't, nor do I think we should, police that," he said. Board member Jennifer McDaniels expressed support for having students and staff wear masks. If that's what the health officials are saying, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the local health department, I think we should follow that, she said, referring to the AAP's guidance that students should be physically present in school. Noss said he didn't think the district would have 100% of the people in masks 100% of the time. Board member Travis Houston said, in my opinion, without a medical reason, masks should be mandated for students and staff. Board member Brian Stauffer asked who could request an exemption and who would decide if the person had a valid reason. From a legal standpoint, the board does have the right to require masks, Noss said. The Department of Public Health makes clear if we want to feel better about school opening, masks are the best mitigation effort to consider. The administration has also talked about shields, said Dave Black, school improvement specialist. The district has some students who are hard of hearing and need to read lips, he said. Students seeking an exemption should have a doctor's note, it was suggested. Board President Doreen Scheffel said, I think it needs to be a doctor's order. I would think we need to have more than just a parent saying, my kid's not going to wear a mask. I think masks should be required for all students, except those with a doctor's order, board member Bob Hendricks said. Essentially, you can't enter the building without a covering on your face. Noss said some staff members prefer shields, and they could be considered an acceptable alternative for people who prefer them. When the school district grants an exception to the mask requirement because of a doctor's note, it should recommend a shield, McDaniel said. She said, if there's an issue with the breathing, I would hope a shield could be an alternative. Parents who have children with compromised immune systems should talk to school officials about online opportunities, Noss said. The district has built up its virtual school capabilities and would have virtual instruction available for students who are quarantined or need to remain at home for some reason. More than 200 people watched the Zoom meeting and many typed questions or comments into the chat space. It would be hard to wear a mask during physical exertion, one viewer typed into the chat. Currently, students are not required to wear masks during outdoor activities. Chris Kirk spoke in favor of requiring masks. If we can keep kids out of school for not having required vaccinations, why can't we keep kids out of school if not wearing a mask? Kirk typed in the Zoom chat field. I support mandating masks for all students, wrote Brianna Cunningham. Thank you to our leaders at Lewis Central for trusting the science and working to keep staff and students safe, typed Rebecca Wilson. Noss said he would talk to public health to determine the best language. He said, we have to ask our parents to reinforce these things with their children. I hope we can view this as it's better than our kids being at home all the time. Noss said the district would encourage parents to check their children daily for symptoms. He said, it had been recommended that schools have two triage areas, one for students who have symptoms of a contagious illness and one for others. What we want to prevent is a kid with a scraped knee from sitting next to a kid with a fever, he said. The school district will practice social distancing as much as possible, Noss made it clear that there would be no guarantee that there would always be 6 feet of space between people. We can't accomplish 6 feet apart in all of our classrooms, but we can spread out, he said. It won't be perfect, but every effort will make a difference. I believe that. The district has considered various means of reducing numbers during high traffic times, Noss said. Lewis Central High School is increasing lunch periods from 2 to 4 each day, Noss said. The district will also reduce or eliminate visitors and volunteers. The district will look to public health officials to do tracing and decide whether schools should be shut down. Also in Council Bluffs, Iowa Western Community College has tightened the language in its fall plan from stating the college, quote, highly encourages, unquote, people to wear facial masks to a blanket requirement, President Dan Kinney told the college's Board of Trustees on Monday. The article is accompanied by a picture of Lewis Central Community School District Curriculum and Instruction Coordinator Kim Jones and Superintendent Secretary Anna Baim wearing face masks as they work inside the district's Educational Resource Center on Tuesday. And there's another picture of a corridor of Lewis Central School with the big logo of the Titan and the wording Titan Hall. At the bottom of the front page, Robert Connolly of the Quad City Times reports, Deere & Company, 82 layoffs in Davenport are canceled. Former Vice President Joe Biden's presidential campaign says President Donald Trump's economic policies hurt families in Iowa, and it is using John Deere & Company's recent layoffs as an example. But Deere officials have since confirmed 82 workers in Davenport will not face layoffs as previously announced. The layoff notice was still available online Tuesday. On June 29, Deere informed 82 workers at John Deere Davenport Works of layoffs effective August 3rd, according to a company statement. On July 16 and July 17, those workers were told, quote, the layoffs will not take place, unquote, Deere's statement said. The 35 layoffs at John Deere Waterloo Foundry, announced the same day, will go forward as planned, officials confirmed. Deere officials said, quote, each John Deere factory continuously balances the size of its workforce with the needs of the individual factory and to optimize the workforce at each facility, unquote. There are 859 active production employees and 317 salaried positions at Davenport Works, and 409 active production employees and 99 salaried workers at Waterloo Foundry, they said. Deere officials did not say what changed to allow the retraction. Workers manufacture construction and forestry equipment at Davenport Works, a segment predicted to see a reduction in demand this year, even before coronavirus hit. There's no question that in a Trump economy, Iowa workers and families suffer, and it's been going on well before the pandemic, said Lauren Dillon, Biden for President, Iowa State Director. Biden, the Democratic Party's selection to challenge President Donald Trump in November, expressed similar thoughts via a tweet in December 2019 when a previous round of 57 layoffs was announced for John Deere Davenport Works. Biden's tweeted in December, it's been just 2 months since John Deere laid off 160 workers in the Quad Cities in part because of President Trump's reckless trade war. And now a second round of layoffs is expected in the same community. The layoffs do not include salaried employees who took part in an earlier buyout round this year. Deere recently announced another round of those. The article is accompanied by a picture of a John Deere tractor as it sits along the edge of some farmland along U.S. Highway 92 near 290th Street near Trainer. The picture was taken on May 10th of last year. And still on the front page, Mike Brownlee reports, Pottawatomie County reports 3 new COVID-19 cases, deaths statewide, now more than 800. Pottawatomie County listed 3 new COVID-19 cases on Tuesday, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. The site listed 926 cases, up from 923, roughly 24 hours earlier. With 12,389 tests, the county's positive rate remains at 7.5%. There have been 707 recoveries in the county, up 11 from Monday, and 15 deaths. On Monday, the state site reported an outbreak at Risen Sun Christian Village, a long-term care facility in Council Bluffs. The company said 19 residents and 11 staff members tested positive for COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. The state site listed 13 recoveries among residents on Tuesday. The state reported an additional 366 new cases for a total of 39,474 out of 423,862, putting the positive rate in Iowa at 9.3%. The state reported 5 new deaths as the number in Iowa climbed to 802. The state listed 28,379 recoveries. In the region tracked by the Nonpareil, Mills, Harrison, and Montgomery County reported one new case apiece, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. Crawford County was the only county to report more than 10 new tests. Page County Public Health reported two new cases, both adults between 18 and 40 years old. And a final story on the front page, Walmart, Sam's Club to close its stores on Thanksgiving. This is from the Associated Press. Walmart Incorporated said it will be closing its namesake stores and Sam's Clubs on Thanksgiving Day this year, saying that it wants to have employees spend time with their families during the coronavirus. The move, announced Tuesday, marks the first major indication of how COVID will affect Black Friday store shopping, which, for almost a decade, kicked off with big crowds on the Turkey Feast Day and expanded into Friday. However, given safety concerns, stores are rethinking their plans for the kickoff. Given Walmart's clout as the nation's largest retailer, other major retailers could follow its lead. Macy's CEO Jeff Gennett said earlier this month that the department store will be pivoting its Black Friday business more toward online and will likely be going full force with holiday marketing right after Halloween. We'll also be staggering events to reduce customer traffic in the stores. Walmart also said Tuesday that it will be giving out another round of bonuses for workers on the front lines of the coronavirus. The company said it will be doling out $300 for full-time hourly workers, $150 for part-time hourly and temporary workers. Drivers, managers, and assistant managers in stores, clubs, distribution centers, and fulfillment centers and health and wellness will also receive a bonus. It will add up to approximately $428 million, Walmart said. The bonuses will be included in August 20 paychecks for eligible workers employed as of July 31st, said John Furner, president and CEO of Walmart U.S. in a corporate blog post. Our associates have been working at an incredible pace. They've solved problems, and they've set an amazing example for others. To further appreciate their incredible work, we're pleased to share another cash bonus this summer. Walmart and others have been under increasing pressure by labor-backed groups to extend bonus pay for frontline workers as surges in new cases have spiked in many states. Susan Payne of the Daily Nonpareil reports Southwest Iowa man killed in crash near Waubonsie State Park on Sunday. A Shenandoah motorcyclist was killed Sunday in a crash outside Waubonsie State Park on Highway 2. Shortly after 9:15 p.m., 50-year-old David Allen Terry of Shenandoah crossed the center line between Bluff and Waubonsie Park roads in Fremont County, the Iowa State Patrol reported. For unknown reasons, Terry continued traveling eastbound in the westbound lane and crashed into a 2013 Hyundai Elantra driven by 57-year-old Esquivel Paul Soriano, who was headed westbound on Highway 2. Soriano swerved to miss Terry's motorcycle, but the vehicles instead collided on the center line, the patrol's report stated. The Iowa State Patrol said Tuesday a number of factors informed the report, including testimony from a witness and accident reconstruction based on the debris field, although the crash is still under investigation. Terry was pronounced dead at the scene. Soriano suffered minor injuries, according to the patrol. We have another accidental death story on the same page, reported from Lamar's by the Associated Press. Man dies after becoming trapped in Northwest Iowa grain bin. A man died Tuesday morning after becoming trapped in a grain bin in Northwest Iowa. The Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office said deputies and other first responders were called to a grain bin about 5 miles east of Lamar's. They were told a 65-year-old man had been loosening stuck corn when he became trapped. Even though there were safety measures in place, he sank into the corn when the crust broke, the sheriff's office said. He had died by the time his body was recovered, about an hour after rescuers arrived. His name wasn't immediately released. Then they have a correction just beneath that story. In the Tuesday edition of the Nonpareil, the incorrect last name was used to detail a federal prison sentencing. Douglas Schlott, 35, was sentenced to almost 6 years in prison on drug charges. The Nonpareil regrets the error. The last name of Douglas is S-C-H-L-O-T-T. And the Face of the Day feature, be it from ship or shore, Evan Lilly loves fishing. Lilly, 11, is an Omaha native, but his family moved to Council Bluffs when he was a kindergartner. He has been at St. Albert Catholic Schools ever since moving, and he will be a fifth grader in the fall. He said, it's been enjoyable growing up in the Falcon family, noting how the school feels like such a tight-knit community. Lilly said he likes that everyone knows each other, whether they're younger, older, or his age. There's a lot of kids here, Evan said. It's easy to be friends with everyone. Lilly is a year-round athlete, participating in basketball, track, cross-country, soccer, and flag football. He said being so involved in sports has been a great way to stay active, meet new people, and learn a sense of responsibility. He said he loves competition and the feeling of victory, and he is excited to be more involved in St. Albert sports as he moves up to middle school and high school. He said basketball is his favorite sport, and his favorite college team is Iowa, and his favorite NBA team is the Miami Heat. He said he loved watching LeBron James win his team a pair of national championships while growing up. When he isn't practicing or competing, Lilly loves hitting the open water to do some fishing. His grandparents live at Lake Panorama, and the Lillys head up to visit them almost every week. Crappie, walleye, and bass are his main targets, and he fishes from boats and shores alike. He said it's a nice, relaxing escape from the hustle and grind of athletic involvement, but he's always ready to suit up and play. And so the picture of 11-year-old Evan Lilly shows a young man smiling brightly with a close-shaved head, and he looks like he's just enjoying life to the hilt. On page 3, a virtual day of dance. It's coming courtesy of the American Midwest Ballet, reported by Chris Kristen of the Omaha World Herald. American Midwest Ballet has been on its toes, planning for a regional day of dance. The event, scheduled Saturday, will be virtual, with free activities and classes celebrating all styles of dance for all ages of participants. The day includes a gubernatorial proclamation, too, marking the 10th anniversary of the Resident Professional Ballet Company and Academy. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts issued separate proclamations encouraging citizens to participate in the Day of Dance for its ability to promote health, fitness, confidence, and self-expression, as well as for its recreational and community-building benefits. Quote, our instructors are excited to share their expertise and genuine love of dance, unquote, said Susan Chowning, American Midwest Ballet School's director. So make sure you don't miss the perfect opportunity to get up and move. The schedule features a total of 15 sessions in 3 virtual studios. There's creative movement for 3- and 4-year-olds, kinder dance for 5- and 6-year-olds, and ballet, jazz, and contemporary, lyrical tap, and hip-hop for youth, teens, and adults. Participants also can take a virtual tour of American Midwest Ballet's new state-of-the-art home at the Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center, 1001 South 6th Street in Council Bluffs. Pre-registration is required at the mballet.org, I'll spell that, mballet.org. The day of dance will run from 12:30 p.m. to 4 p.m., and participation will be via Zoom. Everyone who registers will be entered into a drawing for free tickets to an American Midwest Ballet performance. For questions, email school@mballet.org or call 712-890-8000. 5591. The article is accompanied by a picture of children, and the caption is the picture is courtesy of Jim Williams of American Midwest Ballet. Children as young as 3 can participate in Saturday's virtual day of dance hosted by the American Midwest Ballet, which is in residence at the Hoff Center in Council Bluffs. And there's a larger picture of a couple of young men who are crouched next to what looks like a yellow dinosaur stuffed toy, and they are performing via Zoom for this event. And still on page 3, Mike Brownlee reports, Bluffs man sentenced on federal fentanyl distribution charges. Council Bluffs man has been sentenced to more than 9 years in prison on drug charges in federal court. Larry Schneckloth, 47, was sentenced to 110 months in prison for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl by U.S. District Court Judge Rebecca Goodgame Ebinger, according to a release from U.S. Attorney Mark Quickbaum. The charge was the result of a drug distribution investigation in Council Bluffs, the release said. Schneckloth was convicted of selling fentanyl pills on 2 occasions in Sarpy County, Nebraska, and he was also linked to fentanyl pills located during an investigation at a hotel in Omaha. Law enforcement, through their investigation, attributed more than 3,000 fentanyl pills to Schneckloth, the release said. On December 7, 2019, Council Bluffs police officers were dispatched to a motel in Council Bluffs, where Schneckloth was arrested for a warrant and was found in possession of 95 grams of methamphetamine. The investigation was conducted by the Council Bluffs Police Department, Southwest Iowa Narcotics Task Force, Iowa Division of Narcotics Enforcement, Omaha Police Department, and Sarpy County Sheriff's Office. The case was prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. And still on page 3, we have an item by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, headline, Zebra Mussels Found in Lake Manawa. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources recently confirmed that zebra mussels are in Lake Manawa. A homeowner on Lake Manawa reported finding zebra mussels on riprap along his shoreline. Investigation by DNR staff discovered low numbers of zebra mussels around the lake. DNR staff will conduct additional surveys at Lake Manawa this fall and next summer to monitor the abundance and distribution of zebra mussels. The documentation of zebra mussels in another lake highlights the spread of aquatic invasive species in Iowa waters. The zebra mussels in Lake Manawa probably arrived on or in a boat that had picked up the mussels from an infested water body like the nearby Missouri River, said Kim Bogenschutz, DNR Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator. Zebra mussels look like small D-shaped clams that have alternating light and dark bands. Most are less than 1 inch long. They are filter feeders that can form dense clusters as they attach to hard underwater surfaces. Large infestations may interfere with aquatic food chains, kill native mussels, clog water intakes, increase algae blooms, and cover beaches with dead shells. Currently, there is no effective treatment to control zebra mussels once they have infested a lake. Young zebra mussels are microscopic and can be unintentionally transported with water in live wells, bilges, ballast, or bait buckets. Adult zebra mussels can attach to boats, trailers, and aquatic vegetation. It is illegal to possess or transport prohibited aquatic invasive species, such as zebra mussels, in Iowa. Boaters must also drain all water from boats and equipment before they leave a water access and must keep drain plugs removed or open during transport. Clean any plants, animals, or mud from boat and equipment before you leave a water body. Drain water from all equipment, motor, live well, bilge, transom well, bait bucket, before you leave a water body. dry anything that comes into contact with water, boats, trailers, equipment, boots, clothing, dogs, before you move to another water body. Either spray your boat and trailer with hot, high-pressure water, or dry your boat and equipment for at least 5 days. Never release plants, fish, or animals into a water body unless they came out of that water body, and empty unwanted bait in the trash. For more information about aquatic invasive species and a list of infested waters in the 2020 Iowa Fishing Regulations booklet, or on the DNR's website, that's, I will spell that, it's called at iowadnr.gov, atiowadnr.gov/AIS. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for this Wednesday, July 22nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, we turn to today's obituaries. And today there are 8 obituaries posted. Calvin Maurer, Raymond Calvin Maurer, age 98, passed away on July 20. He was born on the family farm near Minden, Iowa, on May 25, 1922, to the late Clarence L. and Margaretha Duer Maurer. After graduating from Minden High School in 1939, he worked on the family farm for 2 years, taking night school at Fry Aircraft in Omaha, Nebraska, for sheet metal training. In November of 1941, he went to Inglewood, California, to work at the North American Aviation Plant on B-52s. He returned to Omaha to register for the draft. He worked at the Martin Bomber Plant on B-26s until he was drafted. He was inducted into the Army Air Corps in World War II on December 29, 1942, at age 20. He served for 2 years, 9 months, and 13 days. Over half of his tour was overseas as a teletype maintenance person for the 8th Air Force. He was discharged on October 11, 1945. He married Mary Betty Armstrong on July 7, 1945, while home on leave. They had been engaged for 3 years. After his discharge, Ray worked in Omaha at Jubilee as a shipping clerk for 3 years. They moved to Neola, Iowa, so that he could help his father-in-law with his seed and fertilizer business. After his father-in-law passed away, he worked for Standard Oil as a sales and delivery commission agent for 25 years. He also drove the school bus for Tri-Center Schools for 26 years, retiring from both in 1977. He was a member of the Neola Presbyterian Church and Neola American Legion Post 330 for over 60 years. He was preceded in death by his wife of 14 years, parents, sisters, Mildred, Viola, Ruth, Ethel, brothers Kenneth, Robert, and Elmer. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 23rd, at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home. Family will not be present for visitation. Private family funeral service 1 p.m. Friday, July 24th, at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home, with private family visitation the hour prior. The private family funeral service will be live streamed via Facebook Live on the funeral home's Facebook page. The burial at Neola Township Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Neola Presbyterian Church, Neola Fire and Rescue, or Minden Fire and Rescue, or Neola American Legion Post 330. Max Bernard Vance, age 93, passed away July 20, 1920. He was born on October 12, 1926, to the late Bayard and Laura Higgins Vance in the rural Pottawatomie County. In addition to his parents, Max was preceded in death by his wife, Nancy Vance, sons Max and Michael Vance, and his spouse, Linda, brothers Lyle, Keith, and Burl, sisters Charlene, Daryl, and Linda. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 23rd, at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home. Funeral service 10 a.m. on Friday, July 24th, also at the funeral home. Interment is in Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Midlands Humane Society of Council Bluffs, and the arrangements are being handled by the Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Jesse J. Kuhn Nunez, age 91, of Omaha, passed away July 19 in Omaha. Jesse was born January 28, 1929 in Council Bluffs to the late Caterino and Angela Medrano Nunez and attended Thomas Jefferson High School. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force from 1948 to 1952 and spent over 30 years working at ASARCO as a lead refiner, retiring in 1992. Jesse was a devoted member of the Catholic faith and is preceded in death by his parents, brothers, and sisters. Rosary, Thursday, July 23rd, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church on O Street, 23rd and O Street in Omaha, 7:30 p.m. And Friday, July 24th, at Assumption Church on 22nd Street in Omaha at 10 a.m. Interment, St. Joseph Cemetery in Council Bluffs with military rites by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Due to COVID-19, masks are encouraged. Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home is handling arrangements for Jesse J. Kuhn Nunez. Terry Lee Kozad, age 50, passed away July 17 in Council Bluffs. Terry was born May 7, 1970 in Omaha, Nebraska, graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School, 1989. He attended Iowa Western and served in the Army Reserves. Terry graduated from the Police Academy in 1998 and joined the Carter Lake, Iowa Police Department. In 1999, Terry joined the Council Bluffs Police Department and received the Medal of Valor in 2006 and Officer of the Year in 2008. He worked at Cabela's in security management. He was preceded in death by his father, Kerry L. Kozad, in 2018, and his grandparents, Harold and Doris Christensen. Visitation Thursday will be from 4 to 8 p.m. for Terry Lee Kozad, and that will be at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral service Friday, 10 a.m., also at the funeral home with live stream available on the Cutler O'Neill website. Click on Terry's obituary. Interment, Ridgewood Cemetery, memorials to the family preferred. Alice M. Zyk, I'll spell that Z-Y-C-H, I'll say Alice M. Zyk, or Zyk, Zyk, born June 12, 1928, passed away July 17th, preceded in death by her loving husband of 48 years, Stanley Zyk, and brother Robert and spouse Della Novotny. Visitation for Alice M. Zyk will be Friday, July 24th, 10 to 11 a.m., with Celebration of Life, 11 a.m., both services at West Lawn Hillcrest Funeral Home. Gerald, known as Jerry B. Shaw, 43, of Council Bluffs, passed away on Sunday, July 19, at Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Visitation Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Maher Funeral Home. Funeral service on Saturday at 10 a.m. at the funeral home for Jerry B. Shaw. The burial will be at Cedar Lawn Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. Arnold R. E. Hatcher, 74, Council Bluffs, passed away at his residence on Sunday, July 19th. Celebration of Life visitation on Friday, 1 to 3 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Burial of cremated remains following the visitation at Garner Township Cemetery. The family will direct memorials for Arnold R. E. Hatcher. Sheridan L., known as Sonny Thompson III, age 63, of Honey Creek, passed away January 12th. Celebration of Life service Saturday, July 25, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Aeroplane Inn in Honey Creek. Military honors will be tendered by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. The Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring is attending arrangements for the family for Sheridan L. Sonny Thompson III. Turning to the sports page, we have prep baseball stories. Patrick Donahue reports, ticket punched. Peterson dominates fans 15 as Trainer heads back to state. This is from Neola. Trainer on Tuesday was looking for its 8th state baseball tournament berth in program history, and Drew Peterson made sure it happened. The Cardinals senior pitcher was dominant in the Class 2A Substate 8 finals against Carroll Kemper at Tri-Center High School, striking out 15 batters in 6 2/3 innings of work in a 3-1 victory. The only thing preventing Peterson from throwing a complete game was the pitch count rule. Christian Martins came in to record the final out of the game to send the Cardinals back to Des Moines. They last qualified in 2018. "I'm still in shock," said first-year trainer coach Scott Wallace. "It hasn't sunk in yet. The boys have been competing for the last 2-3 weeks now, and we've got this 21-out mentality. We don't take anybody lightly, and these boys have been locked in for the last 7 games." The same can be said for Peterson Tuesday. He routinely kept Kemper hitters guessing with a solid blend of fastballs and off-speed pitches. "Drew was spot on tonight," Wallace said. "He was the Drew Peterson that we all know. He battled all the way through into the 7th inning. He controlled the mound and tempo tonight, and his off-speed was working extremely well. He was able to locate and kept those guys off balance all night. He can muscle up and blow a fastball by them if he needs to. He also has a really good changeup and curveball. When he's got those two pitches working, he's deadly on the mound. He's someone to be reckoned with in the postseason." The Cardinals struck first on a Caden Snyder RBI single in the 2nd inning and went up 2-0 on Peterson's 3rd inning sacrifice fly. Kemper cut the lead in half with a run in its half of the 5th before Ryan Bach added an insurance run for the Cardinals with an RBI single in the 7th. The Cardinals entered the postseason only 1 game above the .500 mark. Now, suddenly, a state championship could be a reality next week in Des Moines. "The sky is the limit. These boys, I told them tonight, we spend 45 minutes on the field with pictures and everything," Wallace said. "I told them to absorb it, have fun, and enjoy the moment. We'll reset, get back after it, and we can get up there and make some noise with anybody in the state, as far as I'm concerned." The article is accompanied by a picture of the team surrounding the winning pitcher after the victory, 3-1. And there's also a picture of pitcher Drew Peterson in full throwing motion as he leans toward the plate to deliver one of his unhittable pitches. Another prep baseball story by Derek Norin. Big 5th inning lifts Mount St. Albert past CAM into state tourney. From Clorinda, for the 11th time in program history and 2nd time in 3 years, St. Albert is headed to the state tournament. Trailing 3-1 after 4 innings, the Falcons used a 6-run 5th inning to take a 7-3 lead, which they'd never relinquish, winning 9-5 over CAM in the Class 1A Substate 7 title game on Wednesday. Although excited, the veteran Falcons seemed like they had bigger goals in mind when the final out was recorded. "It was kind of a tame celebration. I'll just say it was a COVID celebration. We were socially distancing," St. Albert head coach Duncan Patterson said with a chuckle. "They're excited. They never got down on themselves, and that's what's great about this team. They fight and push each other to keep getting better." Lance Wright started for St. Albert and pitched the first 3 innings, giving up 3 runs, only one earned. Eric Mattei entered in relief, throwing 2 1/3 innings to earn the win, and Cy Patterson pitched the final 1 2/3 innings for the save. Mattei had St. Albert's only two-hit game, while Jeff Miller, Ryan Genero, and Isaac Sherrill each had one hit and two RBIs apiece. However, the biggest hit may have come from second baseman Brendan Monahan, who got things going in the fateful 6-run fifth. Monahan's bat got it started, Patterson said. He's hitting in the 7-hole, and he got a 2-3 count, and I'm sorry, 2-0 count, and he just unloaded on a fastball to the left center gap. That started a melee behind him. St. Albert plated two more in the sixth to go up 9-4, and it stayed that way heading into the seventh inning. CAM plated one in the seventh, but Cy Patterson closed the door to send the Falcons back to the state. The 1A state tourney quarterfinals are scheduled for July 24-25 at Principal Park in Des Moines. The official pairings had not yet been released by press time. In prep softball, Patrick Donahue reports from Carlisle. Harlan falls in regional final to number 1 Carlisle. 14th-ranked Harlan saw its season end Tuesday in the Class 4A Region 4 Finals, dropping a 12-0 decision to top-ranked Harlan. The Cyclones didn't register a hit in the game. Carlisle plated 6 runs in both the second and third innings to wrap up the contest after 3 innings. Harlan closes its season at 15-5, while Carlisle advances to next week's state softball tournament in Des Moines. Carlisle's record is 18-3. An Associated Press story by Eric Olson, uncertainty abounds as college football teams scramble to find games fill schedule. Arkansas State's opener at Memphis on September 5th was still on the schedule as of Tuesday. That much athletic director Terry Mohiar knows. Mohiar has no idea who the Red Wolves will play the following week or the week after that. I wish I could tell you something concrete, he said, echoing his counterparts at schools across the country. The coronavirus pandemic has led to the cancellation or postponement of more than 300 Division I games so far, and how much, if any, college football is played hinges on whether the surging number of virus cases can be tamped down. Cancel games, even if it's just one or two, could be crushing financially for athletic programs, especially those at the lower end of the football bowl subdivision and in the football championship subdivision. A team can play a Power 5 conference foe on the road and earn as much as $2 million, often enough to keep other programs afloat or fund the training table or academic center. The scramble to find someone to play between July 9 when the Big Ten announced it would play only conference games this fall. The Pac-12 followed suit. Decisions by 5 FCS conferences do not play this fall emptied even more Saturday schedules. More openings could loom if the Atlantic Coast Conference, Big 12, or Southeastern Conference decide to scrap non-conference games, if football is played at all. Former ESPN executive Dave Brown, who developed software used by 90% of Division I programs to identify possible matchups for non-conference games, said most scheduling right now is being done on a contingency basis because of all the uncertainty. He said it could be rendered moot in a week, 2 weeks, a month, no one knows. Brown said he is seeing mostly verbal agreements rather than written contracts, and cancellation clauses in written contracts are taking into account the pandemic and waiving penalties. Perhaps tellingly, there have been no official announcements about replacement games. Some teams are more willing to go on the road and earn some money rather than absorbing the costs associated with staging a home game in front of a limited number of fans, Brown said. Of course, visiting teams won't be receiving as much as they would in a normal season. Perhaps no school faces a bigger challenge than BYU, which had 5 games fall off its schedule. Utah, Michigan State, Arizona State, and Minnesota to start the season, and a November 28 game against Stanford. BYU is an independent with no conference schedule. Athletic Director Tom Homo said on BYU TV, it's rather wild and woolly. Schools like Arkansas State, Bowling Green, and Portland State of the FCS are among the schools feeling the financial pinch. About 50 FBS bye games have been scrapped. The Red Wolves will miss out on a $1.8 million check for a game at Michigan, and they are also looking to replace a home game against Howard. Mohair, I'm going to spell his name, M-O-H-A-J-I-R, Mohajir, said he has a plan A, plan B, and a plan C, all depending on what the ACC, Big 12, and SEC decide. Ideally, he said, he will find a game at a Power 5 opponent and a home game against an FCS opponent. With no way to recover the full amount of money lost from the Michigan game, Mohair said there will be belt tightening. There is no plan to cut sports, he said. Bowling Green Athletic Director Bob Moosbrugger already had to cut $2 million from his budget this spring, and he's faced with losing more than that this fall because games at Ohio State and Illinois have been canceled. Before the pandemic, Bowling Green was projected to net $1.75 million from non-conference games after paying a total of $500,000 for home dates against Robert Morris and Liberty. Those 2 games are still on. That means the Falcons stand to lose $2.7 million. Portland State could get dinged the most of any FCS program. The Pac-12's decision to play conference games took Arizona $550,000 and Oregon State $400,000 off the Vikings' schedule. Athletic Director Valerie Cleary's department already has lost about $500,000 from its NCAA distribution because of the virus and could face a 10% reduction in state funding. Losing nearly $1 million in football guarantees is another gut punch to a 15-sport department that operates on just $14.7 million. Like Arkansas State and Bowling Green, Portland State will seek some level of payment from opponents that canceled on them. Portland State, however, is not actively looking for replacement games, in part because the state of Oregon is early in its reopening and there could be some travel obstacles. Of course, Cleary said, that could change. We're all getting really good at operating in hypotheticals right now, she said. The article is accompanied by a football action picture of Georgia running back DeAndre Swift running for a touchdown toward the camera and being pursued by what looks like about 6 Arkansas State defenders. And that does it for today's reading of the Daily Nonpareil from Council Bluffs on this Wednesday, July 22nd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.